dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, we continue our series of presentations from the first national conference on peak oil and community solutions that was held last month in Yellow Springs, Ohio. In the previous week's programs, speakers have explained how modern industrial society has been made possible by cheap and plentiful fossil fuel energy, which from this point on will be increasingly expensive and scarce, and how this is likely to impact an economic system which is based on the false assumptions of unlimited natural resources and endless growth. And we've heard how our population, technologies, and expectations of bigger and better are on a collision course with the finite resources of this planet. In this episode, we'll focus on sustainable agriculture in the context of sustainable human culture and examine our assumptions about progress, technology, and social relations in light of our ecological reality. We'll begin with a presentation from the conference dealing with permaculture, a design system that many believe is the perfect tool for transition to the energy descent society, and then a presentation that takes the long view on the development of human society. We go now to the first national conference on peak oil and community solutions, which took place in Yellow Springs, Ohio last month, as organizer Megan Quinn introduces Patricia Allison.
First is Patricia Allison, who has taught permaculture design courses and consensus decision-making for over 10 years. She lives at the Earth Haven Eco Village in North Carolina, whose mission is to create a replicable model of sustainable human culture. Permaculture is a design system which emulates natural patterns, combining ancient wisdoms with scientific knowledge to form a set of ethics and principles for creating sustainable culture. Topics include maximizing food production with small-scale intensive growing, integrating animals, catching and conserving water, conserving and building soil, natural building, appropriate technology and alternative energy, local trade systems, and designing self-maintaining landscapes. Please welcome Patricia Allison.
Okay, good morning. Gosh, I'm so blessed to be here to especially to come now after I've gotten to hear the presentations from these fine fellas. I, as we'll talk later, I teach permaculture from the viewpoint of deep ecology and eco-spirituality. I mean, I teach the whole curriculum, and we'll talk about how to make dams and how to, you know, grow pigs and all those things. But I feel so strongly that permaculture needs to be about culture. So in our permaculture classes, we open with a song. We open everything with a song, in fact. And here's a song. It just happens to be up here on this stage. This is a short and wonderful chant that talks about who we are and what we are doing here. And it goes like this. We're going to sing it a bunch of times. We are the change. We are the ones we've been waiting for. And we are dawning. We are the rising sun. We are the change. We are the ones we've been waiting for. And we are dawning. We are the rising sun. We are the change. We are the ones we've been waiting for, and we are dawning. We are the rising sun. One more time with feeling. We are the change. We are the ones we've been waiting for. And we are dawning. We are the rising sun. Yes, thank you. All right. So I've been asked to talk about permaculture. I have a non-hidden, open agenda. My agenda is I want the planet to take a permaculture fundamentals course. So there's no secret about my aim and why I'm standing up here. I've got about 45 minutes or so to convince you of that. So let me start with some of the basics, a brief history of permaculture. Permaculture came out of the 70s, and it was born in Australia. Two ecologists, David Holmgren and Bill Mollison, David was Bill's student, were looking at a definition of sustainable agriculture. They wanted to look at peoples all over the planet who had been feeding themselves sustainably for sometimes millennia. How did they do it? Well, to make a long story short, what they discovered is they fed themselves with perennial plants, generally tree crops, nuts and fruits and seeds. And in the tropics and to some degree elsewhere, root crops, perennials. Well, now y'all all know how we feed ourselves. It ain't perennials, huh? So we generally live on annuals. So they said, aha, okay, we see what permanent agriculture is. And so they coined the term permaculture. But almost immediately, they had to step back and say, this means people have to have access to land in order to grow trees. And usually, although we would like to create a culture otherwise, usually when we're renting, we don't plant fruit trees or pecan trees. And so permaculture then immediately began looking at why people either have access or do not have access to land. So pretty much immediately when the term was coined, the permaculturists got that we need to look at all the factors involved in sustainable lifestyle. We need to look at political factors, economic factors, educational factors, gender and racial equality factors, all of the factors that influence whether or not we can have that sense of connection and long-term connection with the land. So permaculture became, so the definition of permaculture became something like, and I always have to look at it because, a design system for creating sustainable human culture. So it's about permanent culture. Many of you, I'm imagining, who have heard of permaculture have believed it to be mostly about growing food. Well, it's a heck of a lot about growing food, but it is not just another sort of avenue of organic gardening. This is about lifestyle. Permaculture is about looking at every aspect of our lives, from the way I clothe myself, to what I eat, to where my water comes from, what my economic system is, what, as we talked about last night, what my spiritual practices are, how I educate my children, how I birth my children, how I take care of my healing. That's all permaculture. I often define permaculture as an umbrella over all my isms. Because I was doing a bunch of that stuff, you know. I was an organic gardener, and I was home birthing and nursing and home education and homeschooling and homegrown spirituality. and local economics and all that stuff. But when I got permaculture, it was like, wow, they're all connected. It's all one. So, that's the quick history of permaculture. In the 30-ish years of its existence, well, I guess it was in this, where's David when you need him? I think it was like 74 or so was the first permaculture design course. So we teach a two-week permaculture design course. Now, the way I teach it is it's divided into two one-week sessions. I always try to fudge and make it 8 or 9 days, but because the first section is the fundamentals of permaculture, where you can begin to understand the philosophy, the principles, just the world view of permaculturists. And then the second half of that course is very practical practice of, which is called a practicum, and where you actually practice designing a physical landscape using permaculture principles. And in that time, in the 30-ish years since we've been teaching this, there have been, we estimate, because permaculture is a bit anarchistic about record keeping, we estimate at least 100,000 people throughout the world. And I mean, frankly, Peter Bain and I, who's the publisher of this magazine, Permaculture Activist, we sort of came up with that number, 100,000, probably about 3 or 4 years ago. So, it's all exponential, because when we get the virus, we go out and replicate. So we've probably doubled it since then. Who knows? My point is, a bunch of people all over the world have been trained in permaculture design. So what we look at is that permaculture then, as I said, it's an umbrella. It's a toolkit. In fact, I think David actually, let me sidebar here. It has amazed me hearing the speakers using the exact same phrases that I use to describe our work here on this planet. And so permaculture is a toolkit. It's a toolkit for cultural change. Cultural change from the outside in and the inside out. So the outside in is pretty obvious. That's the stuff about the gardening and the orcharding and the chickens in the front yard and the tilapia pond and the straw bale houses and the solar panels, and that's all that physical, sustainable stuff that we all need to learn how to do. But the inside out is just as important. I don't believe that we will make those external changes unless we are convinced from the inside, that we need to create a culture which will sustain all of those physical changes that we want to make. We have to find and create, recreate, remember the culture of sustainability, the values that will keep us doing the work of healing the planet. So permaculture certainly looks, Megan did me the great service of reading off a whole list of this is the kind of stuff we talk about in permaculture. And throughout the time that we learn permaculture together, we're also learning new cultural practices and giving ourselves permission to remember the kinds of cultural practices that will lead us into and support a culture of sustainability. Okay, where do I want to go from here? Yeah, let me just jump into... what I'm hoping to do is, I've got some notes here, And I want to kind of go through a few of the definitions and the ethics and the aims of permaculture. And then I'm hoping that we'll have time then to do some real practical stuff of looking at these permaculture principles and giving some examples of them. Let me get a show of hands. How many of you out there are permies? How many of y'all have had, wow, look at that, had a permaculture design course? All right. So get your little thinking caps on, because we'll be asking for examples to illustrate the permaculture principles if you come up with some. So let's go. The prime directive of permaculture, simplicity itself. In fact, you're going to discover as I speak and as you learn more about permaculture that permaculture is common sense. There's nothing difficult about understanding permaculture. It's the common sense that we've forgotten. It's the common sense that we need. In fact, I often say, you don't learn permaculture, you remember permaculture. So we, as a part of the human species, and I think that's an important point, and in fact, I'm sure a bunch of you read the book Ishmael. I really like the point that Daniel Quinn makes in that. And if I was an artist, I'd have a nice little diagram, so I'll just do this. He talks about there being this thread of life. I mean, life evolved. We evolved. We co-evolved with all of the other living creatures on this planet. We knew from the time of our beginning as beings that we were connected to the plants, the animals, the rocks, the water, the wind. We knew that. We never, you know. And indigenous people didn't forget. So it was like there's this great strand of interconnected, woven together life. And about, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, some folks decided that they would leap up off of that strand and disconnect themselves from all of the rest of nature. Those were our ancestors, of course. And so I think it's so important. We often say, oh, well, humans this and humans that and humans are just so screwed up and humans. And no, it's not all the humans. It's just us. It's just our ancestors that jumped off of the boat. And I feel like our job is to steer the boat back and reconnect with nature and with all of those pieces that we forgot we were connected with. So let's watch ourselves when we start talking as if all the humans on the planet have made this big oops. Luckily, we still have some models, barely, from indigenous people to help us remember our way back home. So here's the way back home, prime directive of permaculture, quote from Bill Mollison. Sorry, it doesn't say that. Thank you, Bill. Is to make the decision to take responsibility for our own existence and that of our children. Make it now. Never has it been so important to emphasize this as it is now. So take responsibility for our existence. Well, I mean, that sounds easy. We're all existing, aren't we? We got a job and we got money coming in, so we're taking responsibility. Well, what is your existence hinging on? Things like food and water and shelter and relationships with others. Taking responsibility for where your water comes from, under what conditions does it get to your house, and then what happens when it leaves? Does it go to that mythical place called away? Because there's no such place, you know. Although a friend of mine said, you know, if there really is a such place as hell, I think it's away. So all that stuff that we threw away, oh my. So taking responsibility for knowing where that water come from, where's that wastewater going, and why do we call it waste? You know, waste is a verb. So let's not make it a noun anymore. Waste is a human artifact. In my classes, I take my students out to the forest and we stand there. So close your eyes a minute and pretend you're standing on the edge looking into the forest. And it's like, now open your eyes and look in that forest. Do you see any waste? It doesn't exist in nature. So we're the only ones who waste. Okay, so we want to take responsibility. We've talked a lot about food, certainly. Learning, where does your food come from? Who grew it? What are their values? And if you are of this bent, what was their vibe when they were growing that food? What kind of energy did they put into my food that's going to come into my body? Taking responsibility for the education of your children. We send them off to school, and often we don't know that person that they're going to be influenced by for, what, 7-8 hours a day. Is that really taking responsibility for our children's existence? Taking responsibility for all of the natural cycles of which I am a part. So life flows through me, and it's my job to be responsible that that flow is beneficial to the rest of nature. Okay, thank you, Bill. I'm not quite there yet. Okay. I said permaculture is, and I left out a key word, permaculture is an ethical design system for creating sustainable culture. I want to talk about those three words, ethical, design, system. We're going to come to ethics in a moment. Design. Now, I got to confess that the word design intimidated me when I first heard it, because design is something that those highly skilled professionals do. But then it's like, okay, I finally got it. Design is thinking ahead. Design means plan ahead. When I make out the list of all the places I'm going to go, when I rent my neighbor's car to go to town, I'm designing my day in the most efficient way possible. So we don't have to be intimidated by the word design. We all know how to do it. We do it every day. So design means, someone said, make a lot of mistakes, hopefully on paper. Design means making your mistakes on paper. Design means planning ahead. Design means looking at all the components I want in a system, like I want a greenhouse and some chickens and an orchard and a driveway and a house and a clothesline, and looking at all those pieces and figuring out how to put them in my landscape so that they will work together, so that the end product or waste of one of my systems, like chicken manure, is immediately given to another one of my systems. Because what we look at, I've got all these little things here. A permaculture principle is observe and replicate natural patterns. What we see is a natural pattern in nature is the giveaway. Nature gives away. Nature does not have an exchange economy. The tree doesn't say, okay, I'll give you my leaves, what are you going to give me for it? The tree simply gives away its leaves, and the earthworms take the leaves, and the earthworms give away their castings. That'd be miserable earthworms if they didn't, of course. They give away the fertility to the other plants around them. So we give away, give away, give away. That is what nature does. So we learn to give away. I have no idea where I got started on that point. But observing and replicating natural systems. That was about design. Oh, yeah, hooking it up so that the waste of one system gives its nutrients to the next one. So you have an orchard, and you are going to have to go out and buy a bunch of fertilizer and a bunch of pesticides, and you're going to have to maybe till all around that orchard to keep the grass out, huh? Is that what we're going to do as good permaculturists? No. No, you get chickens. So you run your chickens in the orchard, and the chickens do their chicken thing, and they till, and they eat, they do your herbicide thing of eating all the bugs around. They eat up all the fallen fruit, including the larvae of the orchard-destroying insects, and they leave their lovely little deposits. So you have, by integrating your chickens with your orchard, you have now done at least those three functions and more for your orchard plants. So that's the design part of ethical design system. The system part is, we've been hearing all weekend about the problems, the problems that we're facing, and they are multitudinous. And in fact, what they indicate is not a single illness or disturbance of planet Earth, but a whole systemic illness. We are looking at a systemic illness of this Earth. I challenge you to think of any individual or ecosystem that has not been wounded by our industrial, consumerist, materialist lifestyle that we have been pushing onto the entire planet. So the planet has a systemic illness. We need to look at systemic healing. We need to look at the whole system. We can't, like for me to try to design my orchard without integrating my chickens and integrating my compost and integrating my garden and integrating my people, humans wandering through that orchard so they can both enjoy the fruit and be there to notice anything going on that we don't want to have going on. So we see that there needs to be a redesign of all of the systems, the infrastructure that is supporting us. So there's those two words, design and system, and let's talk about ethics. Permaculture is an ethical design system. There's lots of design systems. So we have landscape design and architectural design and automobile design and hairdo design and every kind of design that you can think of. I don't know of any other design system that is based on earth ethics, except permaculture. Permaculture looked at the ways of nature and looked at earth ethics and created this extremely simple set of ethics for permaculture, and we look at these ethics and continuously refer back. Are we meeting these ethics? Real simple, care of earth. Okay, we've got that one. Let's talk about a couple of things. The simplest way that we can understand care of earth is actually the dirt, the soil. If you spend your life taking care of soil, I know you're going to go to heaven. It is, there's no doubt in my mind, because the soil is the foundation of our lives. If we don't have healthy soil, we don't have healthy soil microorganisms, and I'm telling you, I never thought I would get fascinated with soil chemistry. It is amazing to learn about what is going on right there in the soil. The incredible dance. I learned that the soil is alive, and the way you can tell it's alive is because it dances. There is this amazing whole microorganism, multifaceted, very diverse culture that lives in the soil. Our work is to protect it. our work is to heal the damage that we've already done. If that's as far as we ever go in doing permaculture or doing sustainability, that's the good work. So taking care of the earth can be as simple as taking care of the soil. Taking care of the earth, basically, I want to mention a word that troubles me sometimes and troubles one of my blessed teachers, David Holmgren. Many of you who know of permaculture know the name Bill Mollison. Bill Mollison is sort of the charismatic curmudgeon who's gone off into the world and promoted permaculture. But this fella, David Holmgren, who is his student, went home and worked it for 25 years and finally wrote this book a couple of years back. And it is magnificent. And as I think Richard has referred to, he refers to peak oil. And he's the one who uses the description, the energy descent culture. And so he's the one who talks about that we can elegantly, or as elegantly as possible, make an elegant descent if we choose to do so. The word I was going to talk about is the word stewardship. Certainly the concept of earth stewardship is a beautiful concept. And for people who are awakening and realizing that they have a relationship with earth and a duty to do the healing work, the word stewardship, I think, is valuable. I want to caution us that to be a steward of something indicates that you have both the wisdom and the power to properly steward that thing. I don't know that humans have the wisdom or the power to steward earth. I think I have enough wisdom and power and open to learning humility. I almost said hubris. Ha! A little Freudian there, to take stewardship of my little quarter-acre home site, my actually huge quarter-acre home site. That's about as much as I would advocate anybody saying they're going to be steward over. Even that word over is a kind of a giveaway. So let's watch out for that concept. Let's embrace it and not be knocking people down if they use that word, but let's just sort of watch out for the implications of the concept of stewardship. So care of earth, that's the first ethic. And the best way that we care of earth is care of humans. So our job is to take care of the humans. Our job is not to take care of the whales, or the redwoods, or the spotted owls, or the salamanders, or any of those other critters. That is not our job. How arrogant of us that we think we should go and take care of other creatures who know perfectly well how to take care of themselves. They have that knowledge. Our only job when it comes to all those other creatures is to get out of the way and let them take care of themselves. To do the healing work for the habitat that we have destroyed, absolutely, we need to make amends. But our job is to take care of the humans. Now, does that mean take care of humans at the expense of anything that gets in our way? I don't think so. Recognizing that humans are an inextricably linked part of the magnificent web of life. Recognizing that I am connected to every single other living entity on this earth. And so the only way I can take care of myself and my people is to recognize those sometimes very fragile threads that connect me and my people with everything else on earth. So that's our job. Take care of the humans. Sometimes people have had a quick introduction to permaculture and they come away saying, well, those people are kind of anthropocentric. Those people are really human-centered. And they are right. We are. We use the term cultivated ecologies to talk about the landscapes that we create for human habitat. Our job, in fact, is to create human habitat in as small a place as possible so that we can leave the rest of the land for the non-human family. That's our work. Okay. The third one, it's called Share the Surplus. Share the Surplus is sort of a shorthand. It means live in such a way, limiting your population and your consumption, that there's a surplus left to share. Live in such a way, limiting your population and your consumption, that there is a surplus to share. I used to have a nice chart, and I don't, but I think I'm imagining I'm telling this to people who already know all this, but I better say it. There's a habit that some of us have of pointing over there to all those people having all those babies over there, those people overpopulating the earth. What are we going to do about those people in Africa and China and Central America and Mexico and et cetera? Well, those people's babies only use a very small fraction of the earth's resources. So every North American baby that's born right now is going to use about 100 times the resources of an African baby that is born right now. About 20 times the resources of a Central American or Chinese baby born right now. So before we get into pointing fingers about all those babies, we need to look at that other concept of consumption. It's not just population. Carrying capacity is measured by population and consumption. So we want to share the surplus. Again, you know, that's nature's way. That's replicating natural patterns, is sharing. So we want to create our lives of such abundance that we have surplus to share. So what kind of surplus do I have to share? Well, I have a little bit of a surplus of knowledge. I've been learning this stuff for a long time, so I can share it. I've had tomatoes and basil that I got to share this year. My friends have cars, and they share them with me. And my friend, in fact, Peggy, had a car and drove me here. So we share the surplus. I would love to go off on a rant about the gift economy, but I'm not going to. So, the fourth one isn't written in the permaculture books as 1, 2, 3, 4, but it is inferred all through permaculture work, and that is recognizing the intrinsic worth of all beings. I think this is the hardest one, because we have such training that says we're on the top of the heap. We are the masters of all we survey. We are the ones who dictate. We are the dominators. In fact, let me just point to one of the folks that I think is responsible for a whole lot of this revolution, a woman named Rianne Eisler. How many of you have read The Chalice and the Blade? This is on the top of my list for recommended reading for permaculture. Top of my list, because Rianne Eisler, with this book, helped me get it, that it isn't the natural human condition to be warlike and competitive and violent. It isn't the natural human condition. It hasn't been going on since the cavemen, which is, you know, you hear that all the time. Well, you know, it's just human nature. It's been happening since the dawn of time. No, it hasn't. It hasn't. It's been happening for about 7,000 years, 6, 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that. This book is amazing. Please read it. And then after you read that one, I'll just have to say, read the second one. It's called Sacred Pleasure. We live in a dominator culture. We live in that top-down hierarchical culture. It's topped by the big daddy in the sky that punishes us when we're bad. So we want to turn this culture into this culture. into the circle of equals, into the partnership culture, which is a lot of what this is what this book is about. And the word, the term sacred pleasure comes because she defines that the key definition the key aspect of the dominator culture is pain and suffering. No pain, no gain. You gotta suffer to get what you want. Life is hard. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. Yeah. In the partnership paradigm, it's pleasure is the key aspect. Pleasure. We're born to celebrate and experience pleasure. We have bodies with senses. We are embodied pieces of the earth. So we're looking at pleasure as the defining aspect of our culture. Not pain, not suffering, but pleasure. Yeah, right. Every form of pleasure. So, the ones that, you know, you get to choose if it's going to be destructive or not. So, okay. Share the purpose. So the intrinsic worth of all beings, I kind of went off on a rant there, didn't I? Is to recognize that every being on this planet has as much right to life as I do. And we have these terms, weed, pest, criminal, juvenile delinquent, terrorist. These are all those beings that we don't think have intrinsic worth, and we want to destroy them because they get in our way of our progress. So here's the biggest mind switch, paradigm switch, that I think every one of us will be wrestling with probably for the rest of our lives. Because we weren't raised right. We weren't told the truth. We weren't told that we're connected to it all. We were told that we are the master of it all. Okay, breathing is important. Everyone breathe. I'll tell a quick little story on that. I'm always teaching the importance of breathing. And so in my classes, we do a lot of breathing. I was teaching in Austin, Texas, and the location was very near an airport. We didn't discover that until the first day of the class. So maybe every 20 minutes or so, and sometimes, you know, 20 times a day, an airplane came over, and we couldn't hear each other. And so we decided that that was our signal to breathe. Well, those students now tell me to this day, every time I hear an airplane, deep cleansing breath, deep cleansing breath. So it's like, you can choose to, every time you hear an airplane, you know. Okay, so I hope I've given you a little bit of an idea of what permaculture is. Let's talk about what permaculture wants. What are our aims? What are we after? Very simple, very simple. Our aims are to reforest Earth to the extent that it was once forested. Mostly we know that Gaia was once a forested planet. We know that there's a few spots on the planet that are naturally grasslands, or at least, you know, science says that there's some parts of the planet that are naturally grasslands. There's a lot of scientific debate about whether or not there's any such thing as a natural desert. There's some lot of pretty knowledgeable folks who say, there's no such thing. They're all human-generated. Now, maybe they're wrong. Maybe a little tiny patch of desert was part of the plan all along. But we know mostly that Earth was forested. So, again, if the only thing you do in your life is plant trees, you know, stars in your heavenly crown, you get there. I have a friend, the saints of the world is a man named Sid Dubose near Austin, Texas, and he walks around with a big old pocket full of pecans all the time. And he, wherever he is, he's going. Dropping. He's planting pecan trees. So his aim was to plant 100 a day. And I know that for many, many, many of his days, he has done that. So planting trees, reforesting earth is certainly part of what permaculture is looking at. Restoring soil fertility and water quality. I don't think we need to say a whole lot about that, except, you know, yesterday we talked about, we do know how to make soil. Good, fertile, strong soil. And, of course, they go hand in hand because we know about erosion. You probably know statistics like every bushel of produce from conventional agriculture, you lose 7 bushels of soil. And those, you know, those numbers. There's a lot of people, though, who still think that big-time erosion was only happening back in the 30s, you know, the Dust Bowl. But thank goodness that's over. No, I mean, you know, we're still eroding, continuously losing our topsoil every day. And where did it go? Away, and specifically to the ocean. So, and is it serving the critters in the ocean? No. So it's doing lots of damage there. We know that. And so we not only, by restoring soil fertility, which to a great degree means holding the soil on our land and not letting it escape, we are also improving water quality. Okay, the third one. We had a bit of conversation on this already, and growing food where the people are. So we know, you know, the 1,500-mile carrot that we eat. What's your expression? The Caesar salad? The 3,000-mile Caesar salad, right. I went to my local co-op, food co-op, organic, et cetera. They had carrots from Israel. I was like, what? So we want to grow food where the people are. Where are more than half of the people now on the planet? In the cities. So can we grow food in the cities?
Yes.
Good, yeah. One little statistic is the city of Hong Kong, which is, you know, dense population, grows, they say, 45% of its grains within the city, its vegetables, excuse me, within the city limit. Hong Kong, you know, within the city limit, 45% of its vegetables. Within the green belt around the city, 85% of its food, total food. So I figure it must be the rice paddies are around the edges of the city. So we can do it. If Hong Kong can do it, anyone can do it. And luckily, there is a huge movement of urban farms and community gardens. So people are beginning to get this, and this is where a huge amount of the work needs to be done. And then finally, and indeed embracing it all, we need to create a regenerative culture. Now we talk about, I've sort of referred to this already, we talk about creating a sustainable culture and living sustainably, but do we want to sustain the culture we've got? Most of it not. So what we need to do, our job, and probably our children, definitely our children and probably our grandchildren, our work is to create that regenerative culture, regenerative, regrowing, remembering, becoming a culture that we want to sustain. How do we do that? Really simply, healing. Healing wounded individuals. Healing wounded communities, healing wounded families, healing wounded ecosystems. That's our work. We refer to permaculture as a healing art. Through education, that's what we're doing here. That's those permaculture design courses I'm trying to talk y'all all into taking. And that's, of course, all the education that all of us are doing here and elsewhere in our lives. And as we can't help but be teachers. It's not really a choice that you're going to say, oh, I'm going to be a teacher. You're going to be a teacher. And through peace and justice work. So if you've been doing peace and justice work in your life, you've been doing permaculture work. Because permaculture is not about me and my isolated little kingdom living there with my barriers around me. It's about community and connection. So it's, you know, certainly people can take permaculture concepts and they can take them into their own little 5-acre kingdom and they can do that. That's not against the permaculture law. But we advocate strongly that permaculture is about making connections. It's not about isolating. So those are the aims of permaculture. We're not going to look at that last one because it's already been covered. Okay. According to my clock, I've got about 10 more minutes. All right, good. So, a little more sales pitch here. In a permaculture design course, our work is to help you make the connections between the global and local, and to make the connections between politics and your bioregion, to make the connection between despair and action. There's a many of you, probably all of you, know of Joanna Macy, an incredible teacher who teaches about despair and empowerment work. Her message is anyone who isn't admitting to feeling despair, sadness, fear, rage is not being honest. We are all feeling it. We're feeling despair. We're feeling fear, most probably, probably rage. She says very clearly, that's a heavy burden to carry. And when we're carrying that despair and it's all closed up in us, we can't get our work done. We can't allow energy to flow through us. So we need to do the despair work. There's a John Seed is engaged in doing Council of All Beings, Truth Mandala, Despair and Empowerment Workshops. I strongly urge you to do the emotional work that you need to do to empower yourself to get on with the work in the world, because it just drags us down. And when we're so carefully keeping our emotions closed up, then we really can't let any more information in. So that's a piece, and it's a piece that we do in permaculture classes. So, you know, we allow time for crying. We allow time for singing. We allow time for hugging. We allow time for touching. Back on the healing front, another one of my teachers, Andrew Weil. People probably know of Andrew Weil, who's a physician and a rather holistic physician. And he says that a whole lot of our societal challenges are rooted in addictions, not just substance abuse, but addictions to television. War, violence, oil, romance, spending, shopping, competing. We have a lot of addictions. And he says the root of those addictions is touch deprivation. We weren't touched enough. We haven't had enough touch. So in a permaculture class, we always advocate that you got to have at least 13 hugs a day for good emotional stability. So I you know, advocate to you, please start chalking them up. You know, well, I've only had 7 today. You know. So Okay, let's see. We didn't have time. I just babbled too much to talk about any of these things. Let me just, I'll throw a couple of them at you. Okay. Turn problems into solutions. We say the solution is contained within the problem. There's a great Bill Mollison story. The woman says, Bill, what do I do about my slug problem? He says, Madam, you haven't a slug problem. You have a deficiency of duck. So you turn those problem slugs into duck meat and duck feathers, etc. Here's a good one. Pollution is an unused resource. So, of course, we all know about feedlots. That one should just, that's it, all right? You know, I mean, the feedlot is an unused resource, and so it becomes pollution. Unused resources create pollution and work. Permaculturists are lazy. Permaculturists are really into setting up a system that will work for itself. Now, in the early days of permaculture, that point kind of got exaggerated, and there's this little, a Bill Mollison quote is, in permaculture, we want the designer to become the recliner. Well, it ain't gonna happen in your life. So, you know, let's get real. But because we want to avoid work, unnecessary work. We want to do joyful work. Work which is totally blurred, that line between work and play and prayer and devotion and social life. And so we don't even have to use those words to describe what we're doing. We're living our lives joyfully. Okay. This is the one piece I mentioned, your bioregion. I believe if there is a solution, and people will really probably beat up on me for that one. I'm sorry, that's a violent term. People may be a little, have differing ideas about this, but if there is a solution to the challenges that we are facing, it is the bioregional movement, in my opinion. The bioregional movement, let me just sort of read this little description. What's a bioregion? It's a geographical area whose boundaries are determined by nature, not politics. So, the boundaries are determined by the plants, the animals, and the landform, and the human culture that has arisen as in relationship to those natural parts of Earth. The bioregional movement is about 25 years old or so. We will be holding next July the 9th Continental Bioregional Congress. What bioregional groups are doing, I think I said this, but it bears repeating, is that we are creating those parallel structures, that parallel governance, those parallel economic systems. We're basically saying we can disengage. We are disengaging. Now, I know we cannot disengage 100%. You can't jump out of this culture that we all live in, but we can at least take one foot out. And I have flyers about this that are sitting out there at the Earth Haven display, and I urge you to look at it. I don't urge you to pick up this piece of paper if you're going to throw it away. I urge you to take a piece of paper if you're going to go post it someplace or hand it out to somebody else. Website is not on here, but because they're just getting it up. But go to the Earth Haven website, and there'll definitely be a big fat link, and that's earthhaven.org. And Earth Haven, one word.